Spitting in public or anywhere where, of course, there would be other people frequenting. And these are kind of things that you should be doing personally, privately, by yourself, with yourself. These are called hygiene, you know, letting out, for example, we know that there are just common courtesy things that you need to do for your own sake and also for the sake of those who are around you, in honoring them, in respecting them, in honoring yourself, in having some own self-dignity, you know, letting out gas and thinking that's something funny. You know, this is very much against Islam, Islamic mannerism and Islamic etiquette. Inshallah, we'll continue on with our next topic in the next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
...1979, Tehran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October the 24th, 1978. Tehran, the glass prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the glass prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries, and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghass Prison. Over the last two centuries, this building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. Glass Edifice.
Part 1.
Tehran, the Glass Garden Museum. In 2001, the Glass Prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Ghass Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fath Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
تهرانی که ما امروز با این گستره و عظمت شاهد اون هستیم.
During the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Qasr Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khorramabad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure. A large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin, the U.S. ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fateh Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena. Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, the palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion. In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasruddin Shah, the palace fell from grace and abandoned. A devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
در دوره قاجار اصولاً زندان به صورت
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of 3 rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty.
در همین حد زندان در دوره قاجار وجود داشت. اما بعد از رویارویی
But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison.
در فکر تأسیس یک زندان بزرگ و گسترده باشند.
The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms, designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the Brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison.
Thank you.
Under Reza Shah, the gas prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers, and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. Muhammad Farrokhi Yazdi, a well-known poet, was one of them. His revolutionary poems were so critical of the regime that he was imprisoned and his lips sewn together with needle and thread. It is widely believed he was put to death at the prison by venous air injection. In the past, there were two underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the two canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst from the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom, to drink cool water, was coined, an idiom with a pleasant literal meaning, but an unpleasant reference. Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death. The year 1953 is a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister at the time, nationalized the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balance, intrinsic development in Iranian society.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established.
the CIA had even an office in Sabak. And all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
Nipping any protest in the bud, Savak planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners and their inherent difference from criminals, in the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years, Safar Khan Kahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room. He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, Father, I'm your daughter. This is my child and this is my husband. Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, Savak, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became Savak's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
در سال 42 بعد از قضایای 15 خرداد
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently.
سازمان موساد به کمک ساواک آمد و موساد هم یه دفتری رو
It was here that the Mossad came to help Savak. And the Mossad also established an office in Savak and began to train, equip, and exchange information with Savak.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Dawood As'adi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As'adi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
در اون زمان دو نظر، دو دیدگاه و دو راه برای مبارزه وجود داشت.
In those days there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah.
قبول نکنه. ولی ادعی هم بودن که مبارزات مسلحانه را قبول داشتن.
But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
اهل مطالعه بودن، اهل علم بودن، اهل دانش بودن، بیشتر این جنبه رو قبول داشتن.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of Savak agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
از سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
مسیر را بیاد اگر یه زندانی هم آزاد شد دیگه از حواس زندان نکنه مثلا.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودن.
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused and then they gave me a beating.
منو میگرفتن زیر مشکلات دیگه در حد بیحال شدن منو زدن.
They beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. One week passed by, but no one came to release me.
هیچ کس سراغم نیامد. بعد از یک هفته اسمم رو صدا کردن.
After one week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
After endless sessions of interrogation and trials that could take several months, they would be sent to one of the political prisons, including the Qasr prison.
تمام طول مدتی که زندانی در کمیته بود اصلا خانواده از این اطلاع نداشتن.
During the time the prisoner was in the committee, his family would never know of him at all. One could be there for a year or more or less. Whenever their families would go, for example to Evin Penitentiary, they couldn't find their children. That's why some families knew their children were there.
در صورتی بعضی از خانواده ها میدونستن زندانیشون اونجا هست.
It was clear that the Shah had given the green light to Savvak brutality. In hindsight, Savvak harassment merely fanned the flames of the revolution. Mr. Davood Yazdani, a former political prisoner, was a soldier during the revolution. He was arrested for his political activities inside the garrison and spent a long time incarcerated in the Ghast prison. Now he's working as a guide at the Garden Museum.
ساواک یه ظلمی برای مردم ایران توی مملکت ایجاد کرد و سختگیری‌های کرد.
ساواک's harassment and torture accelerated the downfall of the Shah, and the Iranian people became stronger and stronger and continued the struggle to overthrow the decadent regime.
مردم ایران هم روز به روز مقاومت‌تر بشن و به مبارزه ادامه بدن تا رژیم منحل رو از مملکت بیرون کنن.
In 1974, student activities intensified and street demonstrations flared up. With draconian power, Savak set a reign of terror that lasted 2 years. Many were arrested, tortured, or even killed on the slightest charges. This era was one of the darkest chapters in the history of modern Iran.
در سال 55 رژیم شاه تصمیم داشت.
In 1976, the regime had decided to put in prison whoever showed the least opposition, thinking that in this way it could reduce the numbers of its opponents.
میتونه تعداد مخالفینش رو کم کنه. به خاطر همین و به همین علت
Therefore, the prisons of the Shah became overcrowded, that is, political prisons. At that time, the Kasra prison and others were overcrowded.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبری.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
Factors of Islamic Revolution's Perpetuity. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the 10th day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. This revolution has challenged the hegemonic policies of the US and other powers since its emergence and has presented ideals that increasingly to attract modern human. These features have caused the Islamic Revolution to impact the hearts despite the passage of 42 years. One of the factors for continuity of the Islamic Revolution is the fact that it is based on teachings of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and his infallible successors, particularly Imam Hussein, peace upon him. As a matter of fact, Imam Khomeini had designed his movement on the basis of Imam Hussein's uprising and the unmatched revolution of Ashura. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, started the revolution in an era that the liberalist and socialist ideologies had lost their attraction, as they had totally failed to solve human problems. That's why Imam Khomeini said, "Islam and the Islamic government is a divine phenomenon that, putting it into practice, will secure the happiness of our children in the world and hereafter at the highest level. It is able to draw a red pen over oppressions, plunders, corruptions, and aggressions, and will take humans to the ideal perfection." Dear listeners, the Islamic Revolution has proved that no power in the world can defeat it, as it is dependent on God's power. It is God's power that guides the hearts. In verse 63 of chapter Anfal, God says to the Prophet, "Had you spent all that is in the earth, you could not have united their hearts, but Allah united them together. Indeed, He is invincible, all wise." Another factor behind the perpetuity of the Islamic Revolution is that it has been compatible with people's will. The huge movement of the people with a single intention was a rare phenomenon among popular movements. The point to ponder here is that this unity needed to be guided to be effective. The key to victory was in the single leadership, who was uniquely popular, and people from all walks of life loved him and considered it as obligatory to obey his words and orders, since he preached the word of God and Islam. God, addressing the Prophet of Islam, says in verse 31 of chapter Al Imran, "Say, if you love Allah, then follow me. Allah will love you and forgive your sins, and Allah is all forgiving, all merciful." No doubt, Imam Khomeini's honesty, unequivocalness, valor, high scientific degree, and simple way of living had made him the best choice for leadership. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the characteristics of leadership in Islam, "The principle of velayat-e faqih, or authority of the supreme jurisprudent, and the confluence of all main ways of the system to the center of velayat, is the radiant point of the Islamic system. This principle is the interminable reserve that should solve the problems of the Islamic Republic system in the most crucial moments and most dangerous gorges of the course of the Islamic Republic and undo the Gordian knots." human being is naturally in need of freedom, and Islam has always ruled out the dominance of disbelievers on Muslims. In verse 141 of chapter An-Nisa, we read, God will never provide the faithless any way over the faithful. One of the basic principles in Islam is to preserve the supremacy and lofty status of Muslims and the Islamic State. Supremacy of enemies and their dominance over the Islamic lands and Muslims is by no means acceptable. In view of this, any relation and dealing that paves the ground for infiltration and dominance of enemies is strictly prohibited in Islam. Imam Khomeini, as one of the best followers of the Noble Quran, would always behave according to this verse and believe that this verse has very obviously outlined the way of interaction with the enemies. Dear friends, it is interesting to know that in 1989, the foreign minister of former Soviet Union, Eduard Shevardnadze, came to Iran with the message of the Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev. But when he went to visit Imam Khomeini, the Imam didn't shake hands with him, as he was the representative of a superpower in those days. The Imam first showed his courage and trust in God, and also taught to all Muslims that all powers belong to God and other powers are hollow. Shevardnadze told then Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Velayati that he couldn't find any refuge from Imam Khomeini's sharp and compelling look. For your information, dear listeners, the film of the visit is available, and it shows how the Russian official was shaking. Leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Khamenei believes that over four decades of the Islamic Republic system's progress, in spite of the U.S. incessant enmity and conspiracies against the system, is indicative of Washington's failure in stopping the Iranian nation's move. He says, the enemies of dear Iran have exercised different kinds of political, economic, and propaganda pressures against the nation for 40 years. But they failed to do a damn thing even on the day that the Islamic Republic was a novice. The Islamic Revolution has opened a new chapter in every aspect of human society as the precursor of the great Islamic civilization.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamun alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all, and you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, only on IRIB English Radio. And in this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children, and the answers are mostly based upon the book Children in Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Reis Shehri. So I'm Hasnain, and we have our guest in our studio, Brother Miqdad. Salaamun Alaikum, brother.
Wa Alaikum Salaam wa Rahmatullah.
Rather than that, one of our listeners has a question that my 7-year-old is obsessed about football. He loves to watch it and play it as well. That's what he does all day long. Is that okay? So now we get to see that there are many football lovers and, you know, they're really obsessed about football. So what do parents do over here? And is that normal? Is that okay?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I want to say yes, but obviously this yes will come with a lot of conditions and a lot of explanations. So let me.
Seems like you yourself are a football lover.
Yes, I do play football as well. But let me mention a few points. So first and foremost, when it comes to playing football, if the parent means playing football on a computer game or on a video game, then no, there should be a balance to that for sure. I wouldn't recommend it too much on it. Obviously, screen time, it's a lot of mental energy that's wasted. But definitely, I'm not saying stop completely. Definitely, it should be part of our daily timetable. Put some time for playing football on video games, that's perfectly fine. If she meant or he meant that the child plays football, physical football, the real football, sometimes it means that they go out on a proper AstroTurf pitch or an indoor pitch and they play real football with their friends, 7-a-side, 11-a-side, or football practice, basically. That's really, really good, definitely. I encourage it as much as they can. Children need to be active, to need to be doing a lot of sports, becoming stronger. Team sport is very good. Just that, I would like to mention that football is one sport. It's a sport. It's not counted as the best of sports for one's health. It's prone to one is prone to injury through football. And also, as a sport, it's not the best of sports. You have other sports that are better in terms of making your body stronger, more agile, allowing you to have much greater control of your body. Things like gymnastics and swimming and martial arts, these are sports that perhaps are better than football. But having said that, football is still a sport.
But in general, you know, every sport, they have got, you know, some sort of injuries.
Definitely. Every sport has its own stake of injuries. But anyway, that's another discussion for us. Sports is very good. Children should do a lot of football for sure. It's a good sport. It's a team sport. Requires social interaction. Requires skills. Requires strength. It's really good. So definitely encourage children to play. If it means that at home they're just kicking the ball all day long and they go in the garden and just kick the ball here and there, that's also good. As long as they're letting off their energy, they're keeping busy, they're learning new skills, it's fine to some extent. So I wouldn't discourage that too much.
But what the question says is all day long.
I'm sure they don't mean all day long in terms of exaggerated. If it is the case, then definitely it needs to have a timetable, right? We've talked about balanced life, we talked about having a timetable, especially when a child turns 7, 8 year old, then with school homework and with madrasa and Sunday school and with mosque programs and with slowly showing how to learn how to pray and fast, then we should definitely have a timetable and slowly teach a child that you can kick a ball around, but it needs to be at a particular time. I need to tackle your other responsibilities as well. But let's assume this child, for example, does his homework, goes to madrasa. But between two homeworks, for example, he just likes to kick a ball. Or whilst he's waiting for something to happen, whether dad to come back home or for a meal to come, just kicks a ball in there. That's perfectly fine. It's very normal.
Yeah, that's right. And we'll continue after a short break. So dear audience, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we're discussing about children being obsessed about sports or football. So, Brother Magdal, please continue.
Yeah, so if it comes to playing football and sports, definitely encourage it. It's really good for children to be active. I emphasize this point because I know in today's world it's very easy to fall into the trap of video games and TV and tablet and mobile phone and laptops and everything. As much as we can, we should encourage our children to get their eyes off the screen and get active. It means kicking a ball every 2 minutes. Obviously, make sure that it doesn't destroy things in the house. Definitely encourage sports a lot.
But until that, it shouldn't, you know, disturb their daily routine, the things that they should be doing, like, you know, studying and all.
Definitely.
Doing their homework.
After the age of 7, 8, as they've started school and they're busy with other activities, definitely should not disturb that. And it shouldn't become an obsession, right? An obsession in the sense that it's destructive towards other works that they have.
Yeah.
No. If it's like that, then definitely it needs to be controlled. But if it's not destructive, if it's just a way to pass a few moments here and there and to let some energy out, then that's fine. However, when it comes to watching TV, watching football, there's a couple of things. One is that it counts as screen time if it's watched on TV.
Yeah.
So again, it needs to be timetable, it needs to be balanced, it needs to be monitored. If it comes to going out to the stadium and watching football, going to the stadium to watch football, watch the players there, I'd like to make a small point over here, and that is that this culture of following a team, of being a fan of a team, of falling in love or being crazy or being identified by a particular football team, whichever that team might be, I'm not going to here support one team or the other. We need to be careful that this should not lead one to lose their mind and lose their rationality, right?
You know, what happens actually is, you know, when you love one particular team, you know, it creates hatred. The other teams.
Exactly. So it shouldn't lead to one.
Or the people loving those specific teams.
Exactly. It shouldn't lead to one's moral compass being destroyed. Yeah. Right. Sometimes you act in a way because you like a team. So if you being a fan of, for example, I don't know, Liverpool, means that you're going to be very insulting others who don't support that team, or being mean to them, or violent to them, or arrogant towards other players or other teams or other friends, then that's a negative point, right? So being a fan, if it leads to that, then it needs to be controlled. If it leads one to be obsessed in a way that it takes away one's identity, right? Sometimes children, they like football teams, they like supporting a team, well and good. But if it means that now I count myself as, I identify myself as a supporter of that team, and my life rotates around that, that whatever I do is for that team, a kind of identity that loses one's identity. You know, so many youths nowadays, they don't know who they are, they don't know what their values and their principles and even their goals are in life, because all they think of is this football identity that they have, and their values and principles are defined by this football team. This again is negative.
That's an interesting point actually, and let's continue after a short break. So dear audience, stay tuned.
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, "It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood so that he becomes patient in his adulthood."
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we're discussing about the culture of following a particular team and how people lose their identity. You know, they just identify themselves as a supporter of a particular team. So, Brother Mahdab, please carry on.
So this concept of identity, we've again talked about it in previous shows as well. It's very important that our identity remains a Muslim identity, right?
True.
Our values and principles and how we think, what we count as good, what makes us happy, what makes us sad, what makes us angry, what we believe to be true, what we believe to be counted as success, is all defined by Islam, the reality out there. And so we shouldn't become drunk by this fever or this this atmosphere of being a fan of a particular team.
Yeah.
Now, so therefore, I don't encourage parents to enforce it. So I know some parents, sometimes they really want their child to pick a team or become a fan of a particular team. I wouldn't encourage that so much.
Yeah.
At the same time, obviously, it's natural, especially in the world that we live today, you have to be following a particular team or being a fan of a particular team. And this happens naturally when you're at school. So it needs to be balanced. Parents need to be in control of the situation. They shouldn't go into it so much that you lose your child into this identity. And they behave and according to that, and their values and morals and principles are based according to that. So you allow it to happen, but in a very mild way. And this is done through encouraging other things as well. There's other sports out there. This is why we need to involve our children into other sports as well, not just football. We talk about martial arts, we talk about swimming, we talk about other sports. Getting them involved with other activities as well. There's activities out there that are very interesting, are very skillful, that children can get involved in, and to help them see that there's a bigger world out there than just football. Sometimes we get drowned into this football atmosphere and we forget that there's a world out there.
Like, you know, having the question asked in my mind, so, you know, if parents see that, if they observe that, you know, the child is really obsessed to football, and if they observe that he's really good at it, so do you suggest them, you know, to push him forward in that field, like, so that he becomes an athlete?
I wouldn't say yes or no over here. It depends on different circumstances. But
like, he's really good at football.
Let's say he's really good at football. I wouldn't say no to it, definitely. However, remember that this comes at costs. And if this cost means one's religion, then definitely no. I know, for example, if you're in countries like in the UK, for example, right? And if you're so good that you've been picked up by a Division 3 team or even a Division 1 team, right, by some scouts, we have to be careful because it involves a whole culture out there that
against Islam.
That is against Islam, right? And we have to be careful of that. However, if you think your child is able to, let's say your 12-year-old, your 14-year-old is actually quite strong in his religion and he's able to, although it's a risk to take, and you're there to support, then why not? Athleticism and being a football player as a career is not a bad career to have as such, right? But it needs to have the support of the family, support of the community. And it needs to come with a realization that what this means, an entire culture that's very different from an Islamic culture. And if we're able to navigate through this culture without being drowned into it, then yes. But it's risky and it's difficult.
Thank you so much to your audience for staying with us. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, Fiamanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.